You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two UW-Madison students take us on a tour of some of the state's rocks and minerals and tell us what they reveal about Wisconsin's prehistory. Now, the House committee investigating the January 6th attack in the U.S. Capitol is reviewing new documents turned over last week by former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Among them, a PowerPoint presentation that detailed ways former President Trump could have tried to overturn the election results in the lead-up to the protests and riot at the Capitol. We're learning more about the latest findings of the committee investigation and what's at stake. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this and the latest documents that came out from this committee? Do you have questions about what's going on? Is this something that you are concerned about? Do you want to see the committee look at just January 6th itself or wider efforts to overturn the 2020 election results? What do you think is at stake? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again, and it's great to be here again.
I'll ask you the question I just asked our listeners. What do you think is at stake in this ongoing investigation of January 6th and the events leading up to it?
Well, I think the overdramatic answer is to say the stake of American democracy is really, or the stage, or let's say the health of American democracy is at stake. But we don't completely know what's going on, which is partly the whole purpose of the investigation. We know, and I think most of us are willing to say, that what happened on January 6th was not good. I mean, for the first time since what, the 19th century, the U.S. Capitol was occupied. I know some people describe them as patriots, but at the end of the day, this was not good. It was an effort to try to disrupt the counting of the electoral votes. And so part of what the January 6th commission is trying to do is simply figure out what do we know? And there seems to be some evidence, although no one's reaching any conclusions yet, that some of this is tied into the White House. I hate to use the old line from Watergate about what the president knew and when did he know it, but that's what they're trying to find out here. Who was involved in what? Trying to perhaps prevent the peaceful transition of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. So I think there's a lot at stake here. And what the commission's trying to find out at the end of the day, what kind of coordination was there? Was the president involved? Was White House staff involved? We don't have all the answers yet in terms of what's going on, but this investigation is trying to get the answers to these questions. And so all of us, I think, should be interested in this investigation and in what it tells us about American democracy and about what? About what presidents and staff are doing.
Before we dig into some of the details, if the January 6th protests had stayed peaceful or not happened at all, people were already concerned that week about the tapes of the president pressuring the Georgia Secretary of State to find enough votes to flip the election. Some of the documents that have come out involve pressure on Vice President Pence to, in effect, unilaterally reject some states' electors. Would this be worth investigating even if the Capitol hadn't been breached on January 6th?
I think it would be also, too. I oftentimes tell my students that the most important election in American history was in 1800. And it was what? When we had the peaceful transition of power from one political party to another, from the Federalists to what became what's called the Democratic Republican Party. And what has been a characteristic of American democracy for what, over 200 years, has been the respect of a losing party to recognizing the legitimacy of the election, and of saying that, listen, the elections were fair and square, we lost fair and square, congratulations to the victor and move on. And that's what's critical to American democracy and to stable democracies across the world. It's the acceptance of fair election returns. And what we're getting here is what? A troubling sign that in the pressure or the efforts by the president to try to pressure the Secretary of State of Georgia is what? Is not a playing by the rules. It is a effort to what? Perhaps maybe subvert the rules. It is concerns when last year the president and his staff were saying that we have widespread election fraud. the extent of which, even though there's no evidence to support that, we had over 60 court cases that adjudicated this question and basically refuted those claims here. Nonetheless, we've got among those who lost the election this feeling that what? That the election was stolen. And that's dangerous for democracy. And so we need to be doing a better job of understanding, again, who said what, who was plotting what the president was saying in terms of Georgia, the pressures putting on them. All this, I think, becomes important for understanding something about how we run our democracy in the United States.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School, looking at the ongoing January 6th investigation. You can call in with your thoughts, your questions, your worries about what might or might not come out of this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, this House committee has talked to a lot of people, a lot of attention on now one of the people not talking to them, Mark Meadows, former White House chief of staff. He supplied some documents that he said didn't fall into protections of executive privilege. First of all, can you talk about what we've seen and heard about those documents that he provided, including that the PowerPoint presentation, not created by Meadows as far as anybody could tell, but raising some concerns?
Well, what we're seeing at this point is actually an outline here, an outline regarding how the White House apparently tried to come up with a scenario of ways that they could essentially subvert the election and throw the Electoral College in their favor, you know, by whether it is, again, pressuring the vice president, pressuring the counting of the electoral votes, by trying to put pressure on particular states. It really outlines a pretty comprehensive, I'm going to call it sort of comprehensive legal strategy or political strategy for trying to overturn the results of the election. Now, some of it is an effort to manipulate the rules. Some of it appears to be, again, on the face of it, outright illegal. But it clearly is giving us the sense of what? Of the fact that there was something far more coordinated leading up to January 6th. And it's possible that what actually happened on January 6th in terms of the demonstrators heading off to the Capitol was part of a fact of a larger strategy that might have been connected to the White House. Again, we don't have all the data, all the facts in at this point, but that's what we're starting to see at this point, that there's something far more significant than what? Just a bunch of angry protesters showing up on January 6th.
And Mark Meadows now joining some others who have said they don't have to testify in front of this House committee, citing in part executive privilege, saying the president gets to talk to his staff or her staff and doesn't have to. They don't have to reveal those confidential conversations. Makes it too hard to be a president if you can't do that. What do you make of that claim in this situation?
Okay, a couple of things. I know a few months ago I was on this show talking a little bit about executive privilege. And even though the Supreme Court has said executive privilege does protect conversations that the president have in order to ensure confidentiality, the Supreme Court has said two different things. First, the executive privilege really only protects the president of the United States. It doesn't go further down the executive branch chain. And this is the case, U.S. versus Nixon, when Richard Nixon as president wanted to withhold the White House tapes from being able to be subpoenaed. What the court said is that Supreme Court said, whatever executive privilege exists, it must give way to the demands to explore and investigate possible criminality in the White House. And I mention all this because Mark Meadows himself cannot claim executive privilege. He's out of office. The president's out of office. They can't claim executive privilege because they're no longer presidents, or no longer in office. But even if they could, the demands of exploring possible criminality outweigh any executive privilege that exists. That is under current Supreme Court doctrine and current interpretation of executive privilege under the U.S. Constitution. So their arguments, I think, basically again, under current framework of law, are not valid.
But this is a House committee, not a legal investigation. It's not the Justice Department or a prosecutor. Given that, can they say we're investigating possible wrongdoing, even though we can't actually charge anybody with anything?
Yes, I think you can, because here we still have what? Exploration of criminality. We have powers that Congress has in terms of being able to do oversight into the executive branch. Remember also with Watergate, you had simultaneously a special prosecutor operating at the same time that the House Judiciary Committee was operating in terms of doing investigations, and the president was eventually compelled to also turn those tapes over to Congress. And so the parallels, I think, are strong enough between, let us say, the Nixon case and some subsequent decisions that came afterwards and what's happening here, that for all of us who learned at some point the principles of what? Separation of powers and checks and balances. This is the checks and balances aspect of that equation, of Congress's legitimate authority to be able to hold the executive branch accountable and to, again, ensure that it was not engaged in criminal activity. So I think we basically have the same principles going on here.
We're talking about the January 6th investigation in the U.S. House with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Based on what we saw about a year ago, are you worried about the future of elections in the United States? Do you want to see new safeguards in place? What do you want to see come out of this U.S. House investigation, or do you want it to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Hamline University political science professor David Schultz, learning about the latest findings of the January 6th commission in the U.S. House, what it means for the ongoing investigation. You can join in with your comments, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the lead up to January 6th? What do you hope that this House commission gets to, or committee, I should say, gets to? Do you think it's time to wrap up the investigation? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. First of all, I think it's ironic that a man, Donald Trump, who once said that anyone who takes the fifth is guilty, then that's kind of like executive privilege. But I think common sense tells us, even if this committee, you know, it gets so little cooperation from the Republican Party and the former president and his allies, that this wouldn't have happened without him. He told the people to come. He told them that if they didn't fight, they wouldn't have a country anymore. And I heard one of the protesters in his testimony, one of the men that tased a police officer, said that, of course, he was our commander in chief. He told us to come, and if we didn't fight, we wouldn't have a country anymore. So he's responsible, and to trace it to the White House, you only have to trace it to what the man said himself. I mean, that's, you know, in the public domain, what he said.
Willem, thanks for the call. David, what do you think about what Willem says about efforts to say that President Trump is accountable for the people who broke into the Capitol?
Well, that's exactly what the commission is trying to, or the committees are trying to figure out at this point, is whether it is from a legal perspective, or let us say from, let's say, a more political or maybe we're saying an ethical perspective. Those are the dots they're trying to connect. And I know the listener has made some pretty good suggestions here. But again, let us just say for the sake of argument that what we have to do is to get the investigation completed, have people show up and testify so that we can figure out, again, to use the line I used before, what did the president know and when did he know it? What did he say? And was he involved at all in terms of instigating a lot of this stuff?
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. George joins us next in Dane County. George, hi.
Yeah, my question would be, seeing how executive privilege does not hold up for Trump, then all the records should be turned over. My question is, how come they're not?
George, thanks for the call. And David, this is a live legal issue, I think, with the next stop possibly at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, you're correct. At this point, the Trump administration, or let me put this, the Trump and his associates are fighting the turning over of these records to Congress, claiming executive privilege. So far, they have lost in the lower courts. It is possible that this case goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve it. So I think the simple answer at this point is that we're in the middle of ongoing litigation that we assume is going to soon resolve that question regarding does and when he has to turn over those records, if at all.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. George, before we go back to our callers, David, I wanted to ask you about one legal claim that was in this PowerPoint circulated to Mark Meadows that came out of all this, and the memo written by lawyer John Eastman, who later disavowed it. But the central claim is that the vice president of the United States has, in effect, unilateral power to say yes to this batch of electors and no to this batch. Is there legal grounds to make that claim that the vice president can do that?
There really isn't at this point. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution or in the history of the Constitution or any of the laws that suggests that the vice president really has that authority to do any of that whatsoever. At best, the counting of the electoral votes by Congress is supposed to be ceremonial, that if in fact states have followed their procedures for awarding the electoral votes and done all that, all Congress is supposed to do is determine what has somebody gotten to the requisite 270. If they have, that's it. If they have not gotten to that, then they move on to now selecting the president of the United States themselves. But nothing, absolutely nothing, suggests that the vice president has any authority whatsoever in terms of being able to reject any votes himself or basically overturn the election.
Let's go back to our callers now. Derek is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Derek.
Hi there. Thanks so much for putting on this program. My name's Derek, and I'm a U.S. history teacher, and I've just recently taught about the peaceful revolution with the election of 1800. And some of my students frequently bring up the insurrection, and they've had an interesting question. Has there been other times in U.S. history where this transfer of power didn't go according to the plan or not peaceful?
Other hitches in the transfer of power, Derek. Thanks for the call. There was the Hayes-Tilden election took a long time, but it all stayed peaceful. Any other examples you might point a history teacher to?
Probably the only one I could point to is what? 1861, the election of Abraham Lincoln, and then the start of the Civil War. Mm. That would be my best example. If you're going to say that, 13 states, whatever, I forgot how many it was now, the number of states secede from the Union and a Civil War ensues, I would say that's a breakdown in the peaceful transition of power. Yet Lincoln is still president, but look at what happened. So that would be the best example that I would throw out there.
Derek, thanks a lot for the call. Best to your class. Gary joins us next in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Question I have is, I understand there are emails from Meadows to some of the organizers of the protest stating that he was going to get the National Guard to protect the protesters. I'm wondering if the professor is aware of that. And number two, it's my understanding that unless an act of war has been decreed, the governors of the states control the National Guard, not the president.
Gary, thanks for the call. That is another piece of this tranche of documents from Mark Meadows raising the thought of bringing the National Guard to protect the pro-Trump protesters, David.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. I'm not sure how I comment on that. You know, that seems to be the case in terms of bringing them in here. In terms of the president being able to bring in the National Guard, there are some situations where presidents can basically commandeer National Guard, for defense purposes, and under the National Insurrection Act, which goes back to the early 19th century, I'm forgetting the exact date. There are some situations where presidents can also basically bring out the military for the purposes of policing and for basically keeping order. So So there are some situations where that could occur. And I'm, and as I've looked at some of the Mark Meadows stuff that's out there, I think those are the legal hooks that they were trying to invoke in terms of trying to basically, if it looks like it was, trying to get the National Guard to protect the protesters.
Gary, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Albert is on the line in Illinois. Albert, hi.
Hello. My question is, two questions. The first would be, when Trump won the election, there were riots then, but nothing was ever done about it. And then why are the Democrats so afraid of this January 6th so-called insurrection? I'll take it offline.
Albert, thanks for the call. There were protests after President Trump won. I don't remember riots specifically related to that. But David, I think his main question, why would Democrats find the January 6th events frightening?
Well, I'm thinking that what? If we're just talking about the events on January 6th in terms of the protesters, I don't know. I would hope most of us would be upset by the fact that what? There was a storming of the Capitol, a threatening of the lives of individuals who work in Congress, and an effort to disrupt what? A counting of the electoral votes. I would hope that everybody, Democrat, Republican, Independent, would be equally shocked by the fact that what? This is an effort to what? Basically compromise rule of law. And it's not a, that's not a peaceful protest at this point. This is what? This is really what? As we saw, a violent demonstration. I think that is a good reason for anybody to be concerned.
Albert, thanks for calling in. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you to all the listeners.
David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today to talk about the latest from the House committee investigating the January 6th attacks at the U.S. Capitol and the events that led up to them. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, get your garage or other storage space in order with advice on this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. Maybe you can get a head start on a New Year's resolution to get organized and use your space better. I could use some advice like that. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we hear from a retired Wisconsin pastor who started turning donated firearms into garden tools. Now, when you're walking around outside or on a hike, how often do you think about what's under your feet? For our next guest, the answer is all the time. They say underneath the dirt and pavement, Wisconsin's landscape is made up of some really interesting things that tell a story about how much the land we now call Wisconsin has changed over hundreds of millions of years. Lindsay Summers and Benji Johnson are students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They took a physical rock kit from their lab and turned it into an interactive online guide to some of the state's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. I talked to them about the guide and other cool rock stuff on Friday. Benji, let's start with you. Can you tell us where this idea for an interactive online rock and mineral guide came from?
Well, the idea came from the survey because we had this box of rocks, been sitting around for a while, and it's full of rocks that are important to Wisconsin. But we wanted to make it more publicly accessible because, especially since COVID, you know, we can't take these rock kits around to the schools as much. So we wanted to make an online tool to really introduce anybody to the rocks that make Wisconsin as cool as it is. So we made the story map. There's maps, there's pictures, there's lots of fun facts. It's good for any age of individual, you know, teachers, children, grandma and grandpa up north, anything. It's for you. So we just wanted to make a really accessible online tool.
I want to meet some of the rocks and minerals in the guide. Lindsay, can you start us off with dolomite, what it is and how it got there?
Yeah, so dolomite, it's a sedimentary rock, but it forms from limestone, which is another kind of rock. But it forms because of the skeletal materials of sea creatures, which doesn't really sound right for the Midwest. But it's because of shallow seas that covered most of the U.S. about 400 to 500 million years ago, which I think is super interesting. But yeah, that's why dolomite is here in Wisconsin.
So Wisconsin spent a fair amount of prehistory, Lindsay, underwater?
Yeah, some of it.
Benji, let's go to calcite now. And I understand that part of our economy has an interest or has had an interest in that.
That's exactly right. Actually, the reason why Wisconsin is known as the Badger State is because in the 19th century in southwest Wisconsin, when lead mining and zinc mining were really big, the miners dug holes into the sides of the hillsides and they were known as badgers. But most importantly, calcite is often found with zinc and lead. And that deposit is known as the Upper Mississippi Valley Deposit. And that is very characteristic to our region and our state's history.
Lindsay, you included fossils in the guide. Why did they show up there?
So they're pretty easy to find along the shores of Lake Michigan. So we thought it'd be a cool thing to put them in the guide so that people can look at the guide and then go out and find their own fossils. A lot of them look a lot like current sea creatures or seashells and stuff like that. But you can identify them by looking at rocks like dolomite, like I said before, or limestone or other sedimentary rocks like that.
And I understand, Lindsay, you have a childhood history of looking for fossils.
I do. I live in a town that is on Lake Michigan. So when I was little, I used to go to the beach for like hours and just look for cool rocks and fossils and stuff. And now I'm a geology major, so you never know where it's going to go.
Let's check out one more of our foundation minerals and rocks here. Benji, chert has an interesting story.
Chert does have an interesting story. Actually, if you've ever found an arrowhead outside, it's probably made out of chert. So chert is one of those really hard materials that is still great for tool making, but because of the fact it was used for spears and things like that, has a long human history in Wisconsin and in many other places. So chert is really cool. Flint is also a variety of chert, so that's important for fire making, as many people know.
Talking to Benji Johnson and Lindsay Summers, they put together an online interactive guide to some of the state's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. Lindsay, there are some pictures in the guide of field work that you've done. Can you tell us what it's like going out and hunting for the samples you're looking for?
Yeah, so it actually wasn't too hard for us to find a lot of the rocks and minerals because a lot of them are found in some of the same environments. So we went to Port Washington on the shores of Lake Michigan, and we looked for a few of them, and we thought this would be great because other people can look at the guide, see what the rocks look like, and then identify them themselves. And we thought it'd be great to get some of the rocks in their natural environment, which is really accessible to everyone.
Benji, glaciers is a huge part of Wisconsin's geological story. Can you tell us about the role of glaciers in shaping our landscape?
Yeah, many people know. I mean, we take great pride in Wisconsin for having such an active glacial past. I mean, the Ice Age Trail traverses the edge of the last ice sheet that cut across our landscape. But glaciers are important for many reasons. They deposited gravel that form the foundation for many of our aquifers. They've done a lot to deposit good soils for farming even. So glaciers are very important. And I hope that people continue to take pride in our glacial history.
Lindsay, this is stuff that happened on a massive time scale. Hard for me, I'll say, to wrap my head around. What's it like for you to have this, you know, multi-hundreds of thousands of years, even million-year view of the landscape we might take for granted?
So it really is hard to conceptualize for anyone. I am a geology major, and I still struggle to really think about it a lot. But, yeah, I think it's important to consider how long it takes, like millions, even billions of years for these rocks and minerals to form. And when we look around us and we look at these rocks, I think it's really cool and important to keep that in mind.
And Benji,
you really get such an appreciation also because even things like the dolomite that Lindsay was talking about earlier that was laid down by those shallow seas, that undercuts all of the central Great Lakes. And that same layer of rock is actually what Niagara Falls flows over today. So it just gives you a better appreciation for the history of the land that you live on today. I think it's pretty cool.
That's a great place to leave it. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was Benji Johnson and Lindsay Summers, two UW-Madison students who put together an interactive online guide to Wisconsin's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. You can check that guide out for yourself right now at wpr.org/centraltime. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about the history of the Culver's fast food franchise.
We recently received a question to the Wisconsin Project wondering about the origins of the Culver's franchise. While the popular fast food chain feels almost synonymous with Wisconsin now, that wasn't always the case. WPR's Alyssa Alamand recently sat down with Craig Culver to learn more about the Culver's story.
I love this place. Why would you want to live anywhere else?
By the way, folks, I'm looking out over the Wisconsin River, the bluffs across the way.
Just about everyone in Wisconsin is familiar with Culver's. Whether it's the cheese curds, the custard, or the butter burgers that draw you in, its popularity has extended beyond its home state to the greater Midwest and even southern states like Texas and Florida. But have you ever wondered how the food chain came to be?
Sauk Prairie is home to me, home to the Culver family, home to Culver's as well.
Sauk Prairie includes the towns of Prairie du Sac and Sauk City, with a population of about 8,000 people total. The two towns collide on Water Street, just down the road from the current Culver's company office, which was built in Prairie du Sac in 2009. 25 years earlier, the first Culver's restaurant opened in Sauk City.
You know, Culver's restaurant wasn't the first business that we've had here. The first business was an A&W drive-in that my parents had that they started in 1961.
The Culver family sold the A&W and moved on to owning two other restaurants in the area, one of which was a supper club, which is where Craig drew inspiration for the Butterburger. The family bought and sold the A&W another time some years later, eventually coming back to the A&W and converting it into what is now the first Culver's location.
That was in 1984, March of 1984, and July 18th, 1984, we opened as Culver's. And as the story goes, we just about didn't make it through that first year.
The restaurant was located right across from a Hardee's, which Craig said was the fastest growing burger chain in the U.S. at that time. And the Dairy Queen Blizzard was invented in 1985. But of course, Culver's made it through. The first successful franchise location is in Baraboo, which opened in 1990. Craig said growth picked up after that, with the company now operating more than 830 restaurants in 25 states. 142 of those locations are in Wisconsin.
That's our mission at Culver's. It's not to see how many restaurants we can have someday. My mission, our mission, is how many good restaurants we can have. And it takes great people to make that happen.
Rita Larson was an administrative assistant in accounting for Culver's for 22 years. She retired in October. All three of her sons worked at Culver's throughout high school and college, and her oldest son actually became general manager of the Sauk, Spring Green, and Baraboo restaurants.
It's just always been a family atmosphere where all the team members care about not only what you're going through at work, but even your personal life.
In 2020, the franchise opened a record 50 new locations. Craig says there's a plan in place to open another 300 restaurants down the line, which would put the company at 1,000 locations. Craig will always be proud of his roots.
You know, for me, I grew up here. I love my hometown, and I think that's true with a lot of people. Some people, I guess, want to get away from where they grew up. That was never the case with me. I'm very proud to be from here. I'm very proud to grow the business here that we have.
WPR's Alyssa Alamand brought us that story about the history of Culver's. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary-Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll find out how a retired Wisconsin pastor is making gardening tools out of firearms. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A retired Wisconsin pastor says he's tired of gun violence in the United States and wants to do something to draw attention to it. So he uses a forge and blacksmith skills to repurpose donated guns into garden tools. Jeff Wild joins us now. He spent 34 years as a pastor in Madison, Janesville, and Racine, and now puts on blacksmithing demonstrations as part of this project. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's an honor.
How did this idea first get started for you?
The idea first got started when I read an article in an issue of the Christian Century several years ago, written by two pastors who had just published a book. The people are Shane Claiborne, a pastor in Pennsylvania, and Michael Martin, a Mennonite pastor in Colorado. And they, you know, the article was really a summary of their book. And after I read the article, I was interested enough to order the book, Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. And I read the book and really resonated with what they were doing and the theology behind it, their biblical awareness and a summary of the gun situation in our country. And because of my background and interest, I realized I could do this in Wisconsin and decided to pursue that interest by purchasing a forge and other blacksmithing equipment, and then taking some classes over the past few years to try to equip myself to become a blacksmith. And so I reached out to people I knew who might have guns and was fortunate to be gifted a number of them and began to work with them.
Can you talk about the symbolism behind beating not swords, but firearms in this case into plowshares?
Yeah, just to underscore the idea of beating swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks is a biblical reference from the early chapters of the book of Isaiah, which is a prophet, where he talks about the new age to come. And so the symbolic meaning to me is much the same as it was then. It is the announcement of a time of a peaceable kingdom, a peaceable world that people and God's people and humanity are able to participate in. And for me personally, I'm forever marvel at the difference of when I start with a gun in my hands and how that feels to me. And when I complete the process and hold a garden tool in my hands. And I have a love for gardening and a commitment to it. It gives me great joy. So to fashion an instrument that could cause violence and into a garden too that produces food for people, myself, my family, as well as other people, is a very meaningful endeavor.
On a just solely practical level, could you talk about what are some of the biggest challenges in taking a firearm of some sort and turning it into a tool for gardening?
Oh, that's a good question. It takes time and a lot of thoughtfulness and planning and then energy. And so if I were to work with a long arm, say a .22 rifle, I can disassemble it. And there's a couple ways you can do it. One is to cut the barrel right up the middle and use the barrel and out of one I've made two garden trowels. If you cut the barrel up the middle and bend it, you have a very nice looking garden trowel. The other one, I split the first inches that I could use as a digging tool and weeding tool, because the barrel was thicker. The challenge of working with firearms from what I gather is working with a piece of steel that's hollow in the middle, I think it increases the risk of injury because the heat travels up the barrel, and when you put it in a bucket of water to cool it down, the steam really blows out the top of the barrel. And it's hard working with that hole in the middle because of the heat variations between the steel, what's inside and what's outside.
Now, I could see a gun owner saying, well, hang on, I don't think of my firearm as a tool of violence. I might use it for target shooting or for sustenance via hunting, or view it as an instrument of defending myself or my family or my community. What would you say to them about your project of converting firearms to tools?
Well, that's a big question. What comes to my mind is originally, before firearms were being mass produced, Eli Whitney, by the way, gets credit for beginning to be able to produce guns rapidly, mass production, because he was a great inventor of machines to build them. Before, at that time, a firearm was a tool generally used in rural communities on farms for practical reasons. I think you could describe a firearm in a number of ways now, as you have done for shooting clay pigeons, which I have done, for hunting pheasants, which I did in college as a student. In Iowa, or for deer hunting, which I did as a growing up in Beaver Dam with my friends who all went through hunter safety, taught by members of the National Rifle Association. But we also know that the firearms cause, right this year, it was 40,000 deaths. And so in that case, it's fair to say that those firearms are instruments of violence. So that's how I would respond to that question, and then say, what do you say to that?
And now you do public demonstrations. You don't just close yourself up in a shop and convert firearms into tools. What do people see, and what do you talk to them about as you're doing your craft?
Now that's an interesting question. I decided to go public with my demonstrations after hearing about the verdict of Kyle Rittenhouse, because I've immersed myself in learning about gun violence, and I immersed myself in learning how to become a blacksmith. And so deciding to go public, I wanted to provide those demonstrations. And by demonstration is a twofold meaning. One is kind of a show and tell. And the second is protesting firearm violence. In terms of the response of the people who have participated in those demonstrations, I'm told that they're powerful. For instance, I'm not on Facebook, but my wife is. One person responded to the articles that have recently come out in the news by saying the visual's good. You know, it's pretty fascinating to watch someone forge a garden tool out of a firearm, but the narrative that went with it, as he described it, was even more impressive. So I was very happy to hear that, and the other feedback I've received has been quite positive.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your project with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jeff Wild is a retired Wisconsin pastor who started forging guns into gardening tools. He was with us today to talk about his blacksmithing project and what it means. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID-19 has been a big topic in the media for 2 years now. How did big news outlets handle it? A media writer looks at COVID coverage, and you can join the conversation. Plus, author Ann Patchett is with us for a new book of essays called These Precious Days. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.